next question I have for George.
George, is, go for it, George.
All right.
I'll do my best.
How in the world did you guys strike a deal? In other words, when they came back, the two guys with this date, you know, you knew it was open mic, you knew it was real. Did they send you some sample for you to get a feel what it was worth? How did you two sort of
Believe it or not, prior to, you know, his two friends that posthumously, presented, his collection, I had actually written him, and I think I actually spoke to him once or twice over the phone. And now let me tell you this. He was so devoted and so fanatic about Monitor. When I called him one night, I got his answering machine, and the recorded message on his answering machine was one of the Monitor jingles. You know, da, da, mm-hmm. da, 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 you know. And yeah. Finally got through to him, and I talked to him. I had a recording of Monitor, and my intention was to maybe have him, you know, duplicate some of his material and send it to me, but he wasn't interested in that. And then, unfortunately, not long after that, he died. He was severely diabetic, and he died. And about 6 months after his death, these two fellow teachers of his that were looking in after him and took care of him and managed his estate, they were going through his material, and I had written him a letter and, you know, expressing my interest in his collection. And they contacted me, we took it from there, and they made me an offer monetarily. I think it cost me like about $1,000 to buy the whole collection and have it shipped to me. And they shipped it to me in these, honest to God, these boxes were as big as refrigerator boxes. And
yeah.
They were breaking loose, and, you know, they didn't wrap it very well. But the long story short, it made it to my local post office, and it took a team of elephants to drag it out of there to my car to get it all to my house. But the long and short of it, it all survived all these many years, and it sat in different variations of my storage facility, my garage, my basement, my storage facility, for at least 10 years, and. When I noticed that, Dennis had a tribute site, I tried to contact him through his website there, but for one reason or another, I could not make contact because of the technology. I don't know what, it wasn't Google or Facebook or anything, but it was some sort of a, you know, online mail account, and I could never, I kept getting error messages every time I tried to connect with it. I tried that for about 6 months. After about a year, I was able to connect with him, and the rest is history.
So you took a good faith. Did they tell you how many, did they give you an estimate ahead of time before you two struck a deal? Did you figure it was going to be 500 reels?
I think they gave me a head count of how many reels there were, and I jumped at it. And,
okay.
You know, it's like I said before, you know, it was a mixed bag. Some of them were super good condition, and some of them weren't. And the ones that weren't have been discarded, and the ones, the cream of the crop, that is still a substantial collection, remains with me.
All right, Dennis, here's the first question that you've never heard before. Here we go.
Oh, boy, wait a minute. Let me see if I've got all
fasten your safety belt.
Yeah. Okay, so lay it on me.
All right. After 1955, we're saying 1955 is the breakout year for Monitor because it's brand new. All the features are all new, you know, it generates the buzz for NBC. So don't count 55. I'm talking about from 56 on. What were the best rollout features that you really liked over the years? In other words, was there something in 56, 57 you thought was really good? What was, if you look over the 20 years, what would you highlight some of the newer features that they rolled out with that really stepped it up for the station, for the network?
I think one of the really important things they did in 61 was create this thing called Ring Around the World. That was a weekend feature with a special stinger in front and in back where they would go to their correspondents for any breaking story or any situational story. And that opened up the bureaus all around the world, because for every three-hour segment, you would have at least one ring around the world, maybe every hour, maybe more often than that. And it highlighted the correspondence and NBC's strength, and they had great correspondence overseas. So that they used right up until 1973 when they changed the format. I thought the idea of, and this is very strange, they went to a single host in 1961. They had communicators, two people sitting side by side, for the first 6 years, two hosts for each segment. They had to cut back on money on that, and the getting rid of the secondary host, who was a commercial reader oftentimes, maybe read the news, maybe not, that allowed the likes of a Rayburn or a Henry Morgan to open up. They could ad lib without trying to worry about or having to worry about putting the other host in a tough spot to respond to it. Rayburn would never have done well with a co-host. He had to be there by himself. Henry Morgan had to be there by himself. Ted Brown, who would later be on in the 70s, had to be there by himself. And that allowed them to come out. And the third thing, they got rid of Miss Monitor. Miss Monitor had been a great innovation in the 50s. She was Teddy Thurman, a fashion model who read the weather in a way nobody had ever read it, with very lush music in the background, very sexy. They got rid of her, and that was a loss, I think. But then they decided that they were going to have more and more NBC stars, and sometimes CBS stars, do features for them. So in terms of a breakout, I thought having Hugh Downs there with a feature, Arlene Francis, Hugh and Arlene worked on the Home Show in the 1950s. Having Bob Considine there doing his On the Line, he'd been at other networks. And the sports thing, the sports people that they brought to bear, Joe Garagiola became one of the most important people in the history of Monitor in the early 1960s. After he had retired from baseball, he was still doing Yankee baseball as one of the voices, with Mel Ellen, by the way. And they decided, we're going to do a feature with you, because he was this homespun guy, right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
Told wonderful stories. And he was not a handsome guy. He was balding, great personality, made fun of himself all the time. And he became a giant on Monitor. He was there five times a weekend from about 64 right until the last weekend in 75. He had his Joe Garagiola five-minute sports show on NBC Radio on weekdays. And you look forward to Joe. And they made a big push in Monitor for big-name sports people in the 60s. Joe, Mel Allen, was there every weekend doing live sports updates. Sandy Koufax, when he retired as the ace of the L.A. Dodgers. Lindsey Nelson, who was the voice of the New York Mets. All of these sports guys were there doing a wonderful job of updating what's going on or doing features. Chris Economaki replacing Ted Webb on Sport of Speed, Ted Webb dying of a heart attack in 1967, and Economaki replacing him. So those were the breakouts. And the comedy, certainly in the early 1960s, Walden and George, when Monitor brought Nichols and May on board, that changed everything for the next 10 years. They were simply magnificent. So you talk about a breakout, Mike Nichols and Elaine May.
Now, what career did Monitor make? Was it besides Garciola, or were there other careers that really, thanks to Monitor, that really put them on a national level?
Careers that they made? Or
yeah, the careers that Monitor made. You know, they weren't a big star before they became Monitor. Joining Monitor that really kicked up their profile, that became a national figure because of the show.
Well, I think certainly Dr. Joyce Brothers, who was making appearances on Merv Griffin's show and Mike Douglas's show. She was a regular on Monitor from the mid-60s right up until the end, and her name became synonymous with, what, psychology? Was she a psychologist? I guess she was. None of
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
Dr. Joyce, everybody knew that name. Everybody. Joe G., everybody in the world knew who Joe Garagiola was.
Right.
In terms of, boy, because many of the people, most of the people they brought to the show, and George checked me on this, they were already stars, and that's the reason they were on Monitor, is because they were bringing their television stardom or their other stardom, maybe with movies. Barry Nelson was a fine stage actor.
Yeah, great singer.
Al Capp had his commentaries on there until he fell from grace.
Yep. Certainly, I mean, we had stage stars. We had You know, and some of them fit very well on monitor and some did not. David Wayne was the first Tony Award-winning actor on Broadway. He was a fine movie actor. He never worked on Saturday morning monitor because he was too slow, too dour. When they replaced him with Gene Rayburn, it, like, opened up Saturday morning monitor, and it was a whole new show, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't his fault, David Wayne's. He was just miscast on that one. So that's a tough question. So I guess it's Joe G. I guess it's Al Capp, Dr. Joyce. Probably some others I can't think of right now.
Now, internally, were the production team competitive against each other? You talked to enough people in the inside. You know, you explained to me in the past, you know, you had a different production unit were responsible for, what, 3-4 hours at a shot. Were they competitive with each other? Did they keep score among each other who was producing the best content for the week? What was the internal rivalry like?
That's a great question that you've never asked before. I like that question. Actually, first of all, they did not have a great deal to do with the content. They were given content by the executive producer and by their managing editors earlier in the week, so they knew they were going to have this interview, this live shot, this whatever. They might have jockeyed in terms of, I'd really like that live shot, or I'd like an update on that, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody was stealing from anybody else. It was all out in the open. They all had met at the same time, so they knew what they had coming in. Now, for me, if I'd been a producer there, my competitive nature would have been, I want to have a lot of commercials in my segment, because that tells me I'm being commercially successful. However, I also heard from producers and writers who said Saturday Night, for example, which had very few commercials, very few. You couldn't sell network radio anymore on Saturday Night. They loved doing that show because it allowed them to allow their interviews to go longer, to play a bit more of a diverse musical selection. So that was an interesting thing. I wouldn't have thought of that. I would have wanted Rayburn's show. Man, that thing's loaded with spots. Let's make Rayburn move fast, and we're going to zoom through this thing, and we're going to have a lot of great commercials in here. But I didn't get any sense. The sense I got, the overall sense I got, and I'm being very straight here on this, talking to a lot of people who produced that show. Number one, they loved being there. They all loved being there. They wouldn't have gone to TV if you'd given them money to go to TV. They loved Monitor. It was a playpen with typewriters, is what it was. And I did not get the sense of any competitiveness. It was camaraderie. These folks, they would eat together. They would go out and have drinks together. They would associate with their families together. I did not get the sense that, you know, my Saturday morning segment's going to be so much better than yours, as I've got Tony Randall coming in on Saturday morning. I've got Tony coming in, and you don't. It wasn't that way.
How often did they rotate the time schedule for the production unit? Did they change them out about every 6 months or so? That way they have a little variety, or was it pretty much, you know, they sort of knew for year in, year out, they were going to produce Saturday morning or Sunday afternoon or whatever?
Another excellent question, and I happen to know the answer to that. They occasionally did switch out the units. For example, everybody wanted to work with Gene Rayburn because Rayburn was just this wonderful personality who came in, glad-handed you, great personality. Everybody wanted to work with Gene, but only one group could work with him at a time. So, yes, every 6 to 7 months, if somebody really wanted to work with Gene, boom, let's move them over. But it wasn't a matter of punishing the Saturday morning crew. You always said, all right, let's do some of what you're doing Saturday morning on Saturday night. Let's see if we can bring that venue into this particular time slot. So, yeah, they did, particularly the production assistants who were there to write, print the scripts out, pull the records, hand the record to the record player. There would always be an engineer playing the records, et cetera. So writers would often switch out, yes, writers, because some of the hosts, particularly in the 70s, were very difficult to write for. For example, Murray the K. Murray the K, great disc jockey in New York City, was kind of a wild man, shall we say. Murray the K is the guy who, once during a news on the hour, fell over during the newscast unconscious because he'd been doing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a newscast, Monitor News on the Hour. Ted Brown, great disc jockey out of WNEW in New York and WNBC. He came on Monitor for a couple of years on Sunday afternoons. Everybody hated having to write for Ted Brown because writing to him was only a suggestion. He never read what he wrote. They could never get the show out on time with Ted Brown. He was so inventive, so creative. You wanted him to be on the air, but you could not control him. So the writers would float in and out of that. The production assistants loved Ted because he was just a good time guy. But the producers and the writers who had to try to time the show so that it would actually get off at 29:30 and at 58:50 each hour, he would drive them crazy. And so, yes, some hosts, not very many. Dave Garroway was a very difficult host to write for. Easiest, gosh, he had the greatest personality on the air, on radio and TV. So avuncular, so great. He was perfect for today. But Charlie Garment, the longest tenured writer on Monitor, told me a story about one Sunday night. Dave comes in. He's working 7 to 10 for years on Monitor, 7 to 10. He walks in during the newscast. He hasn't pre-read a script. He doesn't know what's in front of him, and Charlie had written it. Charlie is not a man, as I learned, to be taken lightly. You're going to do his script or you're getting out, no matter how big you are. And Dave Garroway was as big as they got. So Garroway, they come out of News on the Hour, and Garroway looks at his script for the first time and butchers it about as badly as you can butcher a script. It bore no relation to what was on the paper, okay? Zero. So Garment is in the control room steaming. And his producer is Parker Gibbs. And Parker says, calm down, Charlie. Calm down, Charlie. Calm down, Charlie. Well, they finally do. They go 15 minutes, and Garroway, what he says has no relation to what's on the paper. It just barely gets anything on the air. Finally, he can't take it any longer. Charlie goes in, and he says, and I'm not going to use the words Charlie said, okay, because this is a family show. But Charlie said, Mr. Garroway, you may butcher this blank, blank script as much as you like, because it's your voice on the air. But I would really appreciate it if just for a few minutes you try to read what's in front of you and see if it makes a difference. And Garroway, as he's going back into the control room, as Charlie's going back in, Garroway says, oh, I'm really sorry. I'll do my best. And he read the script all the way through the rest of the 2.5 hours. But, I mean, Charlie almost killed him that night because Garroway was this marvelous man. You saw him on Today. We've all seen the clips of Today when he was doing that. He was great. Well, same with Ted Brown. Don't even bother writing for Ted Brown. Just give him talking points and see if you can get him off on time. But those were the stories I heard about where writers would get so frustrated at times that they needed to come off and work with a pro who would actually read it. They could, Gene Rayburn could amplify what was being said. He might ad-lib a little bit, but he always got you out on time. He never screwed you on that. And everybody loved working with Rayburn.
Did they break up the production units occasionally just to put new blood, or is it pretty much was it the same group, the same writer, director, assistant working together year in, year out, or did they break them up once in a while?
When you say break them up, you mean bring new people in?
No.
Because number one, nobody wanted to leave Monitor. Everybody loved that show. You might change their time from 9 to noon to 3 to 6 on Saturday afternoon, or go from Saturday to Sunday, but everybody I talked with, and if there had been one person that I talked with who said I hated Monitor, I would have written that in the book. Nobody did who was working on that show. They had people from television coming over from the Today Show begging to become writers on Monitor. They didn't want to work in television. They loved Monitor. So, no, they did not break them up, but sometimes they would move individual pieces for the sanity of the writer, not because they were bad hosts, because the hosts were, out there, really out there.
Arlene Francis had a gig on it for a while, right?
Oh, gosh, yes. She was sponsored by Orlon 33, by DuPont, the carpet maker, and by a paint company. I can't remember the paint company.
DuPont.
But was that DuPont as well?
Yes.
Yeah, so Arlene, still on What's My Line, of course, widely known as a stage actress, a screen actress. It was a great deal to get her on Monitor, and she did these feature stories with people, strange people, big stars, Mrs. America. You would never do a Mrs. America. I don't even know if they have a Mrs. America now. That seems sexist, doesn't it?
Okay, what's the inside scoop about the after a strike of April of 1967 where the management substituted for the on-air hosts?
It's a great story, George, and Walden, hold your next question while
okay.
I answer this one, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it went on for two weekends and involved all of the talent, on-air talent of all of the major networks. And of course, that meant newscast talent as well. It was a writer's strike of local, the O&O stations, writers, news writers, went on strike. They were AFTRA members, and AFTRA set up picket lines at the O&Os and at the networks. They were striking for, now you're not going to believe this, $25 extra a week. That's all they were looking for. So the networks took the strike. That meant that The Tonight Show with Carson went into reruns. That meant that Brinkley stayed off NBC's newscast, but Chet Huntley broke the picket line and was ostracized forever after that. It meant that Walter Cronkite was no longer doing the CBS Evening News. And what was his name? Arnold somebody sat in, a writer for Walter Cronkite on the Evening News. And on Monitor, it meant Rayburn, McMahon, Ted Steele, Henry Morgan, and Brad Crandall were gone. Who sat in for them? Well, we got to hear Robert Wogan, who was the vice president for NBC Radio, Steve Lubunsky, the president. We heard Steve White, who was an operations manager. We heard George Skinner, who was the station manager at WNBC Radio in New York. He filled in for Gene Rayburn. All of these guys came in, and virtually everything on Monitor was different because you had these guys hosting. The writers were still there. They crossed the picket line. But here are a few who also crossed, and this shocked me. Arlene Francis did some stuff during that strike. I don't believe Joe Garagiola did, but I can check this as I'm talking here. So for 2 weeks, everybody was off, and then they settled just in time for the Academy Awards that was supposed to be hosted by Bob Hope that Monday night on the third week of the strike, and they came to an agreement because Hope had said he would not cross the picket line, not cross it. So the strike ended after 2 weeks in April, and the next weekend the hosts were back. They never mentioned what was going on. And while they were on the air, the executives hosting Monitor also never mentioned. Everybody knew it was the biggest, you know, one of the biggest stories across the country. So that's the story. They struck for $25 and crippled the radio networks and television networks. And they got their praise, by the way.
What was the backup plan on the weekend? Did they have an extra host on call just in case somebody got sick? Did they have a second production unit behind the scene just in case somebody got sick? How did they cover themselves just to make sure they weren't short-handed on a weekend?
There were always people you could bring on to host Monitor because everybody wanted to do it. And so as George indicated earlier, we've got Alan Ludden, Jim Backus, Van Johnson, George Carlin. There were people out there, if you said, would you like to host Monitor, Tony Randall, they'd come on because it was a very big deal. So that wasn't an issue, the hosting thing. You could also have a host do double duty. Henry Morgan sometimes did double duty. Gene Rayburn, I think, once did a double duty on Monitor, you know, hosting Saturday morning and then coming on Saturday night or Sunday night, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of the production crews, you handled it the way anybody else would handle it. If you were a teacher, you'd bring in a substitute teacher, so you'd have another writer who was writing for another segment fill in for that particular segment. It would put them in a crimp because they'd have to write for both. But the bottom line is you would get the show on the air. That was never really a serious problem that I ever heard about. There was no flu epidemic that wiped out Monitor or anything like this. But the hosting, I think, was really the least worrisome aspect because you could put out the word and have any one of a dozen hosts come in. You know, Bill Mazur did a lot of hosting. He was a talk show host on WNBC Radio Sports Talk. He hosted Monitor. You could bring people in. Garagiola became a host in the middle of his Monitor career. So that wasn't a problem, Walden, because there are always people out there loving to do that show.
Did they bring people in just for the week, for the special weekend? Did NBC put them at a certain hotel, or did they give them some fringe benefit, that, you know, if there was somebody from L.A. that they wanted to bring in for the weekend? How did they handle, you know, the goodie packages to get them to take care of them for the weekend?
Well, the handling would be that you'd probably bring somebody in from New York City. You wouldn't try to fly somebody in from Los Angeles to host Monitor. You had enough people, enough star power there to host it. As far as the goodie package, they were paying their hosts in 1967, and I did that calculation right before I got here. Yes, all right. They were paying Rayburn and Bill Cullen and Henry Morgan, Ed McMahon, about $750 for the 3 hours they were doing in 1968. That's the equivalent of $6,500 today for 3 hours. You would go in for $6,500 for 3 hours.
Well, so the money got them in there. Can I jump in here? There was an instance where they were hurting for a top-of-the-hour news broadcaster, and they flew in Jim Ruddle from Chicago from WMAQ to host, do the top-of-the-hour news broadcasts. What was going on there? Why didn't they use any of the local news people?
I think that's lost to history, George. That's absolutely a great question, and we have on the website several Jim Ruddle newscasts.
Yes.
He monitored on the hour. We have that. Don't know. But remember, they were owned and operated stations. They worked for NBC. He might not even have gotten any extra money to come in. It just would have been his assignment out of WMAQ. They would have flown him in, certainly. But they would have said, look, you're either on MAQ this weekend or you're doing Monitor, and you're going to do Monitor. It's more important than the O&O. So, yeah, we have that example. And sometimes you have WNBC people. Not often, but WNBC people doing Monitor, doing the newscast, et cetera. Bill Mazur, as we say, is certainly one of them. But and Wayne Howell, who was an announcer on WNBC, became a Saturday Night Monitor host in the early years, in the 1960s, et cetera. But I don't think it was a problem getting people to fill in. You never had a situation where, gosh, who's going to host the show this weekend? God, you put out, who would like to make $2,000 an hour for 3 hours of work, and all you have to do is speak?
Now, come to think of it, Hugh Downs did a lot of featurettes on it, too.
Oh, a ton. And he was hosting the Today Show at the time.
Right. And Concentration, the game show on television.
Yes, yes, yes. So I am looking back now. I am back to April of 1967, and I am looking in on the strike weekends, and we had two strike weekends here where AFTRA was on strike. So I'm going to see who broke the picket line here. And the answer is, besides the hosts, of course, who were NBC management personnel, Chet Huntley, he broke the picket line. Arlene Francis did. I'm going down the list here. Al Capp did. You did not have Mel Ellen stayed away. You had somebody nobody's ever heard of doing sports. And let's see. You had Huntley, Arlene Francis, and Al Capp. I do not see. Yes, I see a Joe Garagiola sports report here. So you had some stars who broke the picket line.
And they lived to tell about it.
They lived to tell about it. But most likely. What they also ran that weekend was a considerable number of Monitor on stage performances involving, you know, record albums or stuff.
Yeah, they were all pre-recorded material.
Exactly, exactly. So that's how they handled the strike weekend.
Did they ever rotate the host to a different time spot just for fun? Did they ever say, well, we want to see what he sounds like in the afternoon. We know he sounds good in the morning, but did they ever just play with the schedule a little bit?
Well, the guy who got his schedule played with the most was Gene Rayburn. Rayburn had been on Monitor since 1961, and he started out briefly as the Saturday afternoon host, and then they made some other changes and became the Saturday night host. But he was so talented. You knew, and we have a couple of Gene Rayburn's Saturday Night Monitor pieces from 1964, I want to say.
Yes.
And it's obvious. This man is so talented, you're wasting him on Saturday nights. You're wasting him because you don't have a lot of advertising going on there. So they kept moving him around, and he filled in for a lot of people. Whenever anybody went on vacation in 65, Gene Rayburn would sit in. And you knew he was going somewhere. And finally, when David Wayne's contract came up in 66, they moved him to Saturday mornings, where he stayed for the rest of Monitor's life, basically, because he was so good at Rayburn. Another guy they moved around in the early going to test him out was Brad Crandall. We have Brad on Saturday afternoons. We have him on Sunday afternoons. We have him on Saturday nights. He was a WNBC talk show host who had gone to work there in 1964. Brilliant. Brilliant talk show host. Great voice, great interviewer. Monitor wanted him on the air, but they couldn't find a place for him until Frank Blair's contract ran out in 67, the Today Show newsreader. And they decided Frank wanted out. He didn't want to do Saturday nights anymore. And so they moved Brad into Saturday Night Monitor, where he stayed for 3 or 4 years. So those balls, and the answer to your question is, yes, they tried people out. But if a host was perfect in the slot they were in, McMahon on Saturday afternoons, Morgan on Sundays once he got there, and certainly Rayburn on Saturday morning, you didn't mess with that. Because the risk was, if you messed with it, and you had somebody else fill in for them while they're doing something else, you may lose the audience for that great host on Saturday morning. People may say, I don't want to hear that guy. I want to hear Rayburn. So they didn't do it very often.
Now, you mentioned Saturday night had a different feel for itself. Could we say the Saturday morning sound different than Saturday afternoon? Does Sunday morning sound different than Sunday afternoon? Could a listener tell a different vibe for every block?
I could. Could you, George?
Yes.
Saturday morning, I'll do Saturday morning, and you do McMahon on Saturday afternoon. How's that?
Yeah, I've noticed that, yeah.
Saturday morning monitor came out of the chute like a rocket. Number one, fully sponsored. You could not put any more advertising in that 3 hours. Everybody wanted to advertise because every advertiser knew, number one, that portion of Monitor would never be preempted by baseball. There was no baseball from 9 to noon Eastern time, ever. No football games. Rayburn was outstanding to drive the show. He was a perfect personality, great energy, wonderful energy. You had all of the advertising with great commercials, very well done spots. You gave Rayburn the very best of the best. Rayburn was the guy who was going to get Sandy Koufax, Bob Considine. He was going to get Al Capp. He was going to get Arlene Francis. He was going to get them, okay? So Saturday morning monitor was so energetic. You just couldn't even imagine. You're out there. You're feeling the best as a consumer. You're driving on Saturday morning, going shopping, whatever you're doing. Millions of people out on the road. You've got the weekend ahead of you, and Gene Rayburn perfectly exemplified, we're going to have fun this weekend. You're going to come along with us. It's a great show. Stay with me.
Gene Rayburn was the class clown to end all class clowns. He was the guy that you'd always, you know, listen to just to cheer up.
Oh, absolutely. Great presentation. What he was on the match game, he was on monitor. He was fun, quick, just a delightful
spontaneous, just off the top of his head, kind of like a Groucho Marx.
Once they got him on Saturday mornings, there was never any question he was never going anywhere. He was not going anywhere. That was his slot. So talk, George, about your impression of Ed McMahon. I thought he was perfect for Saturday afternoon. What did you think about him?
Yeah, I loved him. You know, he was just, good in his own way, and, he had a great voice, and, just a lot of wit about him, and just the Irish humor, that sort of thing.
Every time they'd go to a station break at the bottom of the half hour, he would say, in Wichita, Kansas, you're listening to us on KSNN. Hello, Wichita.
Hello, Wichita.
No, Ed was perfect. Ed was perfect. Saturday night, a completely different vibe, because once you got past the 7:30 to 8 o'clock half hour, which was the first half hour of Saturday Night Monitor, the commercials waned because advertisers, they were willing to think that there were still people on the road from 7:30 to 8. But after that, man, there isn't a lot of commercial action there. So they tried a lot of things on Monitor. They tried a lot of things. Henry Morgan was there for a short period of time before he moved up to Sunday afternoon, and that was perfect for him. But Ted Steele, I thought, was very good for Saturday Night Monitor. He was a big band leader.
A little bit more subdued than the early Saturday morning, but that's what you would expect later in the night.
So they had longer interviews. They had a little bit more music. Ted was fine for Saturday night. And after Ted, they started rolling the dice with Murray the K. And Murray actually did okay on monitor. He did when he wasn't, collapsing on drugs. Murray was okay, but that was a different vibe. Nobody thought Murray would work. But Murray worked. So Sunday afternoon, George, you take Sunday afternoon first with, I thought Barry Nelson was outstanding as a Sunday afternoon host. Just outstanding.
Had a great voice, great demeanor, and a great cadence about himself, and had, everything that you would hope, you know, in a show host.
And he was
he had polish about him, a demeanor.
He was wonderful.
Yeah.
And he was also starring. Remember, he was starring.
Yeah, was starring on Broadway in Cactus Flower at the time.
This was a guy everybody knew, and Barry could have been there forever. They loved him, but he got involved in another play, and it took him away from Monitor after 4 years, and that was a loss. But Henry Morgan was an able replacement because Henry was the iconoclast who could come off the script and make the most outrageous statements, and yet they were funny. What did you think about him?
If he had just played a record he didn't like, you would know about it instantly.
Henry Morgan was the guy who had grown up in network radio as the advertising basher. He got fired from shows, advertisers deserted him. He was calmer at this stage of his career. He was calmer. But he made it clear he would have fun with interviews. He'd do a lot of the interviews on Monitor on his segment. He'd have fun with those interviews. But if he, as you say, if he heard something that was so ridiculous, he had to comment on it. He commented on it. He didn't give you any doubt about where he stood on what he just heard.
He never held back.
Oh, no. And then Sunday night was always the serious night. And that was the night that Dave Garraway had pioneered for 6 years. And the serious interviews, Dave was brilliant at that, just magnificent. Succeeded by Frank McGee, a very hard newsman, and a good host on Monitor, went through the desegregation of the University of Mississippi that night, for which Monitor won a Peabody Award. He was live on the air, and they were doing live reports from all across Mississippi, and the New York Times was quoting Monitor the next day because Monitor was so far ahead of what was going on. And then we got Frank Blair, who was the great and narrow and great voice newsreader from the Today Show, Mr. Blair. And then Brad Crandall, who was a very, very fine talk show host from WNBC. All serious demeanors. They could all have fun, but more serious. It was a more serious thing. Sunday Night Monitor has the same vibe that we all felt on Sunday nights. Oh, boy, it's almost over.
Brad Crandall used to do some great, you know, on occasion. They'd have Brad Crandall do one-on-one interviews with in-studio guests, and, you know, sometimes you could tell he was really enthused about it. Somebody he was interviewing would say something that would amuse him, and you'd hear this explosive belly laugh out of him that was just so infectious.
Yes. He did that particularly a couple of times with Margaret Truman, President Truman.
That's right, yeah. I remember that.
A great deal of fun. So it was a different vibe on Sunday nights, and Monitor reflected that. By the way, our buddy Louie has just weighed in here. Thank you, Louie. He has reminded us, George, that Arlene Francis was sponsored by O'Brien Paint.
That's right.
And make sure the paint you're buying
is O'Brien. You can't put anything past Lewis.
Yeah, yes. And Don Spuler says, yes, he said Brad was on Sunday nights, too. Yeah, Don, we just said that, and thank you for writing. And Don Spuler from Los Angeles, still listening, also says he was the first person to write an email to the website way back in October 2001. Don, you were the first, and there have been a lot since. Thank you so much for still being with us. Walden, you keep asking us questions. We're knocking them out of the park so far.
You're doing good. Well, just for everybody, thanks to Dennis, we got some new stuff we're going to be playing here. Once I let Dennis and Joyce go here in a few minutes, but just be aware of that. And so stay tuned and enjoy. Well, do you have a particular guest that were, if you look back at the history, there's one that were on more times than not. Were there a special guest that really the Monitor team really loved to invite to talk to? Were there certain people like that?
Groucho Marx back in 1963. The interview with him and George Burns.
Tony Randall was always.
Jack Benny was on quite a bit, and always Bob Hope.
Well, Bob Hope was he was one of those must-haves because he was the linchpin of NBC.
That's right, under contract for eternity.
So if he was going to be on the Tonight Show, he was going to be on Monitor that weekend. And Bob was always fun. There's no question about that.
Right.
I'm trying to think of other guests. I mean, there were a lot of people. Everybody came through Monitor at one point or another. Steve Allen, Jimmy Durante, as you say, Groucho Marx. They all came through. But
were there ever any guests that it was just one and done? The NBC staff was just not too happy with them.
Yes. Ted Brown tells the story. Nina Van Pallant. That's right. Nina Van Pallant, who is an actress slash singer. Ted Brown tells this story on the last weekend of Monitor when he was interviewed by Big Wilson. Nina came in for an interview with Monitor, and Ted was going to be the guy who did it because he was the host of that segment on Sunday afternoons. And Steve White brought her up from the lobby at Radio Central to the fifth floor, and she said, "Who's going to interview me for Monitor?" And Steve White said, "Ted Brown," who was big-time disc jockey on WNBC. She said, "Who's Ted Brown?" "Well, Ted Brown is standing right there." And Ted Brown says, I'm Ted Brown." And she says, "Well, who are you?" That got the whole thing off so poorly, and that apparently was the single worst interview that anybody did. She never came back. That was the end of the story for her on Monitor.
I remember, too, an interview they had with Ed Wynn not long before he died, and he just kind of opened up and he just bared his soul about where he went wrong in life and where he went right and his happiest moments and the saddest. It was very enlightening to listen to. It was sad and happy in the same time.
It was one of the best interviews I've ever heard on Monitor. It was great. And Brad Crandall had a lot of great interviews on those Sunday nights. And do you remember the night Brad Crandall did the live thing with the Mentalist?
Oh, Doninger. Doninger, yes.
Now, they've been promoting this all weekend, and George, you jump in on this one. They had Doninger in Radio Central with an audience. Now, Radio Central, the studio that they were using was across from the Monitor studio. It was a WNBC radio studio, but WNBC was not using it because Monitor was on the air. So they had a studio audience that this guy had never met. He didn't know who these people were. He went in there, and so they said, "All right," and he did this the entire half hour. Doninger goes up to these people, and he just looks at them, whether he touches them or whatever, and he starts talking about them. He's never met these people. These are random people that NBC got off the street, okay, in front of Radio Central. He was so right on these people, it shocked me. Georgia, I don't know how that works, because I don't believe in ESPN. I don't believe in that either. ESP, extrasensory perception. But you heard it. He did it.
Yes, I wish he was still around. I need all the help I can get.
Actually, he was well-known. He had his own radio show in the 40s, and he was an expert to debunk mediums and everybody. He was a well-known guy to break the spiritual choice because he said all of them have tricks, and that's what he was known for.
There were great memorable guests, Walter Matthau being in favor and pulling down his pants because they were talking about how the studio always gave you the clothes when you were acting and you got to keep the clothes.
Mm-hmm.
So after the interview's over, the show's not on the air. It was a pre-taped thing the day before or so. And Matthau shows him it's even down to the underwear. They give you the underwear. He pulls down his pants, and here comes a tour group right in front of the Radio Central.
When he was doing The Odd Couple on Broadway, right?
Yes. And then, of course, the story about Raja, the Mina bird, the bird who could say everything. So they brought him into Gene Rayburn, because who else would do a Mina bird but Gene Rayburn, right? And instead of taping the interview, they brought this bird in live on a set.
Uh-oh, should have been a 7-second delay.
Well, it wasn't that. It was that, and all the trainer came in, and Rayburn's live on the air with this bird. And so Rayburn asked the bird a question, because the bird answers anything, apparently. The bird understands what you're saying. And the first answer was, "Oh, Christ."
Oh, wow.
All right. Let me ask you this. The bird answers, "Oh, Christ." That's all Gene can get out of this bird. Well, Gene handles this, right? I hope we get this tape, by the way. Everybody told me about this interview. We don't have it on the website. So they finish this, and Gene's having fun with this. You know, Gene's making wisecracks and all this great stuff. So they get off the air. They go to the commercial break, and they're going to some music. The bird starts talking up a storm.
Should have had the bird do this.
We belong to an hour and 40 minutes, and never actually given out the URL of the website, Dennis.
Well, we should, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, let's do it.
Before we do that, Louis has weighed in with another one. Robert W. Morgan, a great disc jockey at KHJ in Los Angeles. You know that, Walden and George.
Oh, yeah.
Los Angeles. And this is reference to, did they ever fly anybody in to do monitor? Well, they did not fly Robert W. Morgan in. He did the show, I believe, from Los Angeles, and it was taped.
Ah.
It was never a live show.
Okay.
So that's what they did. The website. And, again, this is free of charge. 600-plus hours of monitor, plus the entire history of the show.
And more coming.
More coming. More pictures, the history, audio, more audio than you can ever listen to. Monitorbeacon.net. I'm going to spell that for you. One word, monitorbeacon. monitorbeacon.net. Monitorbeacon.net is the website, free of charge. The book is Monitor Take Two. I'm not making any money. I mean, you know, I wrote the book out of a labor of love, and it got back my investment. Let's put it that way. Actually, it sold several thousand copies. I was surprised by that, George. Did you know that we're ranked in Amazon's top 50 or 100 books ever sold?
That's great.
I didn't think that would happen. I really didn't, but I'm gratified by that. And you know what? Do you have another question, Walden? Ask George another question.
No, I'm good. I'm good. I'm going to save the next one for year 19 for next, you know. Yeah, I got to save a few, but no, we're good.
Walden and John, George gets the last word on this. I just want to say this. It is a delight, and I mean this entirely and sincerely, to be on this broadcast 19 straight years with you guys. We've never missed a year. We miss Jim Taylor, who was with us for many of those years, a great expert on radio. And I know you guys miss him. I certainly miss Jim Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But a great man. He died in January 1st or so of last year, unfortunately.
Oh.
But a young man. He was a year or two younger than I am. And if I'm a young man, he was a young man. At least I want to think that. But anyway, it is my great privilege to be here. I will do this as long as you invite us and as long as I can do it. 19 consecutive years. Next year will be our 20th. That will mean we have done this as long as Monitor was on the air.
I know. Isn't that something? Yeah.
George, you get the last word. You are a great man.
Okay, thank you very much. All I have to say is good night, Dennis. Good night, Walden. And good night, Lewis. We're a little late, folks, so good night.
And good night, Don Spuler. Thank you so very, very much.